Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by the whole team, the full Monty, if you will. Deputy Editor Matt Matum.
Hello.
News Editor Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And Reviews Editor Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
I mean, the full Monty, but nobody's stripping on this one, right?
Not yet.
Yeah.
I mean, we may get to that. We could.
See how it goes.
Plenty of time.
So
yeah.
This
warm
week...
out.
Well, it's getting to be summery. You could be sat there doing nothing and no clothes on. Right. So this week we are talking about only one film because there's nothing else really of note out. But there is one big film out, A Bunch of A-Holes with a Mission, The Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. And we will be talking about it with no spoilers. Don't worry. We won't be spoiling it for you. We're literally going to give you a taste of whether it's good or whether it's bad or whether it's somewhere in between. But before we get onto that, what have you been watching apart from Guardians of the Galaxy, boys? Jordan?
I've been watching the new dystopian Apple TV Plus series Silo, starring Rebecca Ferguson. Hits the service this week. It's based on a novel by Hugh Howey. It's set entirely in this 144-story underground silo because the surface above is uninhabitable for some unspecified reason. We're not quite sure. And it's all about a kind of conspiracy mystery about why everyone's living in this silo, why they can't go back up on the surface, why people are mysteriously dying. And Rebecca Ferguson is at the heart of it and has to find out what's going on. And I've been lucky enough to see the whole thing and I really, really enjoyed it. It gave me real Andor vibes. I'm a sucker for dystopian stories about, you know, ordinary people fighting a system. So this really pushed all my buttons. And Rebecca Ferguson is just, yeah, great fun in it. Very, very fiery, very forceful. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
You've seen the whole thing. So is it one of those ones that's going to be like a Lost scenario where you get to the end, but actually you're not at the end? Or is it a satisfying package to watch this season?
I mean, no spoilers, but it is based on a trilogy of novels. And I would say that the first season does not adapt the entire trilogy. So don't go in expecting a full story from this. But it does leave you on a note where you feel moderately satisfied with where it's got to. If this should be a one season and done deal, I wouldn't feel entirely cheated. That starts on Friday with the first two episodes, and then it'll be airing weekly after that.
And where can we see this?
Apple TV Plus.
Okay, colour me intrigued on that one. Matthew Leyland, what have you been watching?
I went back to the cinema at the weekend to see the 40th anniversary re-release of Return of the Jedi, which I've seen many, many times before.
I was going to say, that's not your first time, is it? No.
It's not my first time, no. But it's the first time I've seen it on the big screen in quite a while. So that was a bit of a treat. Especially I saw it in Leicester Square, which is where I first saw it 40 years ago. Time has flown by.
So this is a formative film for you. This is the one that, out of all the Star Wars trilogy, this is the one that's closest to your heart because it was...
Yeah, this is my favourite.
The one that you sort of saw the most as a kid. And so was the magic still there on a big screen?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And just seeing it on the big screen with the big sound system, huge screen. I mean, I saw it in the super screen at the Cineworld Leicester Square. So yeah, it brought back all those memories of seeing it those many years ago. It was quite a treat, quite a nostalgia trip. And I'd remembered every single second of it as well, even though I'd seen it about a decade ago in full. But yeah, it wasn't a single second of it I'd forgotten.
Little Matthew Leyland was delighted inside.
I was.
Matt Matum, what have you been watching?
Talking of nostalgia, I caught up with Peter Pan and Wendy on Disney Plus, which is David Lowry's latest live action adaptation of a Disney classic. He obviously did Pete's Dragon, which was much more of a reinvention of the original. And I liked it, actually. I wasn't blown away by it. I almost thought it wasn't the most child-friendly film, really, considering it is a Disney animated classic adapted, you know, for Disney Plus, which is obviously, you know, in a lot of ways the home of family viewing these days. But it feels more like it's aimed at grown-ups looking back on their own childhood and pondering it in a slightly philosophical way. But I did enjoy it. It was kind of, so not the most exciting for kids. I watched it with my nearly six-year-old and he absolutely loved the bit with the crocodile, but for him there sort of wasn't enough crocodile. But I found it, enjoyable. It's really classy. So it's not the most exciting, but it just feels classy. It feels like it's made with love and craft and it looks really nice. Like it was all filmed on location in Newfoundland. So you feel like you're in a real earthy kind of place. So there was lots of things like that I appreciated it about it, even if I didn't totally love it as much as I've loved some of David Lowery's other films.
It has been described by one critic as a sort of Terrence Malick for children.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, the visuals, there's obviously something a bit Malicky about the visuals and the wandering through the greenery, but that was about as far as it went for me.
Okay, well, nice choices, but there is a big film out. Were you very excited about the one we're about to talk about? Or where are we on our superhero fatigue before we went to see this?
So, yes, I was looking forward to this because I'm very, very fond of the first Guardians of the Galaxy. I think it's possibly my favourite Marvel film. I think they have been a really enjoyable presence throughout the series when they've popped up in other films. They're always a lot of fun. So I always enjoy them. And I was excited about this because I did the interviews for the magazine feature, which is in the Indiana Jones issue, which is still on sale now if you actually want to read it. I was excited by the fact that this was promising a sense of conclusion that, you know, we know James Gunn's going on to DC after this. And there's just been a lot of talk, and they've all been very open about this is, you know, this is the last ride. This is the last iteration. You know, this is the last outing for this iteration of the Guardians. They were very much approaching it with a sense of conclusion, which you obviously don't get a lot in things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is always kind of building to the next film, the next big event, and the next crossover. So yes, yeah, so I was excited by that that side of things, even if I haven't been totally blown away with this phase of Marvel, to be honest.
I mean, superheroes are still making money, right?
Yeah, but less money than they were at a certain point in recent history. Very recent films like Shazam Fury of the Gods and even Ant-Man Quantumania have been thought to underperform at the box office, whereas once they were just surefire bets to be in the highest grossing films of the year come the end of the year. I think this will probably fare better because already it's coming out to more positive reviews than those two films in particular were. But there is definitely the sense post-Avengers Endgame that there just isn't the momentum. There isn't the rampant fervor that there was for these films during those first few phases of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's really felt like we're just spinning the wheels, like we're just waiting for something big to start going again. That seemed to be coming in focus with Jonathan Majors Kang, but who knows what's going to happen with that character, given everything that's going on in Jonathan Majors' personal life at the moment, whether that is actually going to end up being the focus at the end of this, at the end of these phases. So I think, yeah, people are just looking for, well, a quality film, which I think Marvel has been guilty of not necessarily delivering on of late, and B, just something that feels like we're building towards an endgame, to put it one way, which I don't think anyone has really felt even up to this point, despite these promises that we're going to have these two huge Avengers films in a few years.
Yeah. Okay, so shall we discuss then whether we have an endgame film and a quality film? It's time to grab your raccoons. It's time for this.
I'm going to tell you something. I'm Star-Lord. I formed the Guardians. Met a girl. Fell in love. That girl died. But then she came back. Came back a total dick.
Oh, please. He left out some important information, but that is the gist of it.
So this is Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 3, in case you hadn't guessed. Matthew Leyland, tell us where we are with the a-holes this time around.
Well, I mean, it's been a few years since the Volume 2, but lots of key events have happened outside of the core Guardian series. So we had Gamora dying, and then a different version of Gamora coming into the Avengers movies. We discovered that Star-Lord and Mantis are actually brother and sister. Groot died and came back again. So there's been quite a lot of water under the bridge, and we kind of find them in a sort of relative sort of holding pattern. They're kind of Star-Lord's kind of mourning the loss of his Gamora, but they're relatively settled. But then a new threat comes along in the shape of Adam Warlock, who was kind of introduced at the end of the second movie. That's Will Poulter's character, and he leaves Rocket, Bradley Cooper, grievously injured. And so this kind of cues up lots of flashbacks into Rocket's origin story, and the Guardians have to go on a quest to find the thing that's going to cure him, that's going to save him. And we find out a lot about his essential creator, the high evolutionary, and he kind of becomes the big bad of the movie. And as usual with Guardians, there's lots of kind of chasing all around the galaxy, lots of different planets, lots of different settings, lots of battles. And eventually it all comes to a head and you're kind of sitting there waiting to find out who's going to live and who's going to die. I mean, that's kind of that's the sort of big questions that everybody's been asking about this film, I think, really, from the start.
So, I mean, Rocket has always been a very key sort of quippy figure in the Guardians. But for much of this, he's lying immobile. Mm. But we are seeing a different version of him as a little baby. Does that work for you? Did you enjoy this idea of stripping back the layers of Rocket to find out who he is? Or did you just enjoy a raccoon that's a wisecracking raccoon? Do you need to know a raccoon's backstory?
I did. I really liked all those scenes. I enjoyed, you find out more about him and his companions, his other furry companions. I thought all those scenes were well done and very touching. But I did think there was a bit of a jarring tonal shifts between those, because they can be quite sort of bleak and a bit harrowing, and then it's kind of back to the sort of comedy with like Mantis and Drax kind of screaming at each other. So I did find out throughout the film there were these tonal shifts that were a little bit tricky.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like an anti-vivisection film, this sort of portion of it, isn't it? I mean, I don't know about you, Matt, but some of it was quite grotesque actually, and little kids might not enjoy this. What did you reckon?
There are a few moments in it where I sort of thought it pushed the boundary for a 12A in terms of suggested violence, and also in terms of, just this
torture.
Mistreating of the animals. Mm-hmm. It sort of reminded me a bit of Sid's toys in Toy Story in a way, where they've had all these kind of mechanics like attached to them in quite a rough way. One of them's got their eyes kind of looks like they're being pulled open by these little sort of claw things that are attached to its head. And
The bunny has no mouth and has like weird mechanical limbs.
Metal jaw spider. Yeah. Horrifying.
There was a bit I found really grim that I won't go into too much detail, but you see the high evolutionary kind of testing his methods on some other animals. And there was one bit of that I found really quite freaky. And I thought that would have freaked me out as a kid. So, so things like that pushed the limit a bit. So I think I would advise this for me would be for older children nearer that 12 end of the spectrum, because obviously with a 12A, kind of take any age child with an adult. But to me, it was the upper end of that. And especially in terms of kind of language. And I mean, a lot of people like this, and to an extent I did like this, but there's a lot of grotesquery in the film in general. Like there's this kind of extended sequence, a bit like, again, it felt like a classic Guardians film in the sense that they go to these different locations, visit these weird different, fortresses to sort of, say it broadly. They go to this one that's like this kind of bio-engineered sort of, space station type place, where it's basically like made out of flesh.
Yeah.
And it's
absolutely biological.
Disgusting. Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it looks hideous. And there's all this yellow gunk everywhere. And it was actually repulsive, and there's quite a few repulsive visuals in it, which again, a lot of people will like as a refreshing change. Like it doesn't just feel like any kind of, blockbuster you've seen. It does feel like some thought went into the design, but it's gross in places.
Jordan, let's talk about the big bad then, who is the sort of the god of these sort of grotesque worlds and these horrible creatures that are amalgams of machine and animal. You mentioned Kang earlier. How does this big bad stack up? Is he fearsome? Is he terrifying? Is he somebody that's, a keeper for the ages in terms of baddies?
I have to say I wasn't familiar with this character from the comics. This is my introduction to the High Evolutionary, so I can't really speak to whether this is a, broadly faithful version of this character. He's played by Chukwudu Iwuji, who James Gunn fans will know as one of the characters from Peacemaker. And he's very much a character with a god complex. He's just a classic genius maniac, essentially, who is using his unparalleled genius to, in an attempt to create this perfect society of animal people. For me, he's probably one of the less interesting Marvel villains. He's all tied into Rocket's backstory, essentially. Rocket is essentially a child of the High Evolutionary. You don't really get much from that character other than just pure megalomaniacal insanity. There's no clear reason why he wants to create this perfect society. There's no clear reason why he treats Rocket so terribly, despite the fact that Rocket is this incredible creation of his. I wasn't super wild on the performance either. No. I thought it had two registers, which were, you know,
shouting and quietly speaking.
Exactly. I felt there was no middle ground there, which you really needed. There are just very odd moments as well. There's a moment where he's kind of acting drunk, and I didn't really understand why he was kind of drunk in that moment, why he was so off his feet. That was all very bizarre. And you only really get him in these flashback moments. So it's a very sort of elliptical introduction to this character where you're just seeing snapshots of him over a period of time as Rocket is created and grows up over a matter of months or possibly years. So you never really get a sense of where this character has come from or what his future deal is. Like, he just wants to create this perfect society, but to what purpose? Like, I wasn't fully on board with this character, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, I didn't understand his motivation at all or who had formed him. You know, like the idea that, oh, you know, it's important to look at characters and how they've been formed. So this is what we're doing with Rocket, but we're not going to bother doing that at all with the person that's created him. Like, we're not going to give any sort of understanding of, you know, I mean, he's essentially one of those people where you're like, who hurt you? You know, I want to know with him, who hurt you? Why do you want to create these worlds? Why are you so brutal in, if they're not perfect, then getting rid of them? There's that sort of element as well. And also, you know, not to be awful, but it feels a bit like, so what? If he's off in the galaxy doing that over there, it's not actually affecting the Guardians, apart from obviously they're brought into the story because of Rocket's ailing body. But really, like, it doesn't feel as big and as threatening as other baddies to me. What did you think, Matthew?
Yeah, similar, really. I think maybe part of the problem is that there's so many characters now in the sort of the core Guardians, and then they've added in Adam Warlock as well, and brought back his mother, Elizabeth Debicki's character. So there's so many characters to attend to. I think maybe they just kind of ran out of space, really, when it came to the High Evolutionary. So he kind of just ended up being a bit of a two-dimensional character. There wasn't really much more room. I mean, perhaps that ended up on the cutting room floor, but I mean, it's a very long film as it is. So it felt like he was just kind of squeezed to the margins, really. He's just this abstract threat to the rest of our heroes, and the focus is more on them.
Let's talk about Warlock then. Who enjoyed Warlock, Will Poulter, in his gold paint and his cape strutting around space? An enjoyable addition to the Guardians?
Yes, I agree. Yeah, he was very funny. I really liked his accent. I liked the look of the character. I thought, a bit like what Matthew was just saying about the High Evolutionary, it feels like he was a bit squeezed for time. And obviously, this is a bit of an introduction to the character, knowing how Marvel works. You know, you imagine maybe we'll see him again down the line. But there was less of him in this film than I was expecting. He kind of blasts right in at the beginning in this enjoyable big action scene. And then you sort of don't see him for quite a long time. And he was much, much more of a humorous character than I was expecting. I was expecting something much more straight-laced, but he's almost like mostly a comedy character, I would say, really.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is he's essentially just been born, so he's basically, he has the mental capacity of quite a young child, essentially.
He's petulant, learning everything. Isn't he?
Yeah, he's sort of learning everything anew as he's doing things. Like, he sort of learns what pain is as it's happening to him in the moment. It's very much Will Poulter in the We're the Millers register, where he's just this big man baby, essentially, which I found quite funny. And yeah, actually quite unexpected, because I'm a bit more familiar with the Adam Warlock character just from the comics and from the recent Guardians of the Galaxy game, where he's just a very serious, sort of very verbose character. So I was almost taken aback by this just being a very different version of that character. But he is extremely powerful, and he is more of a physical threat for the Guardians than the High Evolutionary is. He's a bit more of the heavy, the lackey, who comes and messes them up every so often. So I always felt in the moments where he was around, like, bad things could happen, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, he's the blunt instrument. You know, the High Evolutionary is thinking about his grand plan, but Warlock is the one that is literally smashing the hell out of everyone and causing destruction and ripping friendships apart by sort of putting this threat into their lives. Let's talk about the actual Guardians and the core Guardians and Star-Lord. There is an arc for Star-Lord here. Jordan, does it work? Does it pack an emotional punch? We obviously start with Peter Quill at the beginning of this saga and the traumas that he's had in his life. Does this feel satisfactory?
Yes and no. A bit of a wishy-washy answer. because there are like a few things going on here. Because of course, I mean, the big thing going on with Star-Lord post-Endgame is that he's lost Gamora, essentially. His version of Gamora. Gamora is in this film, but as you will know if you've been keeping up with these films, it's a different version of Gamora who has no history at all with the Guardians, no history with Peter Quill. So that relationship is nothing here. So essentially, you have a bit of a rerun of their relationship from the very first Guardians film, where Peter is essentially trying to win Gamora back during their mission. But this Gamora is very much against it, like in a very quite aggressive way. So as well as that, you also have the fact that he's thinking about home, thinking about the fact that his grandfather is probably still alive back on Earth, and should he do something about that? Essentially, you know, this is a broader question about whether this film feels satisfactory as a conclusion to the Guardians trilogy as a whole. But for me, that arc wasn't resolved entirely satisfactorily. I would say this film in its entirety didn't feel to me like a final chapter, and that's a lot down to what happens with Peter. I don't want to say that.
No spoilers, Jordan. No spoilers.
I know. It's very hard not to spoil, isn't it, when you know what's happening? But yeah, it didn't feel to me like they really thought about this being a final chapter. It felt like this was just a story they wanted to tell. It really could have happened at any point in the MCU, to be honest. It didn't hugely feel like a post-Endgame story to me. And by the end, it just felt like they sort of reneged on their promise that this was going to be the last one, because they do sort of leave doors open.
Yes. Let's talk about the emotional wallop of it. The idea that this is sort of the goodbye sign off, that this is supposed to leave you warm and fuzzy, but also in tears. It really tries hard. It feels to me very much like you can see the mechanics of that. It feels manipulative and cynical in a weird way, which, as we know, all films are. That is the point of them. They are a mechanic to make you feel something, but it felt like it tried really hard and didn't succeed with me. Did it work for you, Matthew? Did you feel tears?
No, not quite. I mean, there was a sort of a point, maybe about 2/3 in, where I felt like it was heading towards a kind of emotional high point, but I felt like it didn't quite go over that edge. And then I did feel like the last maybe quarter was a bit sort of a bit overkill, really. And the action really takes over in that section, which kind of shoved out the emotion for me, really. I found it, you know, I enjoyed it overall. But yeah, it wasn't quite the kind of the thunderbolt I was expecting from the way it had been, the way it had been hyped up as this kind of grand finale for these characters.
Yeah. Do we expect too much after Endgame and the destruction of that and the, oh my God, everyone, half the people have gone. Matt, yeah. do you think it's too difficult to try to top that? Or, I mean, are there other MCU films that do move you for tears and this one maybe didn't?
Well, weirdly enough, like the first Guardians, I said, I love that film. And I shed several tears during that the first time I watched it, not least probably the We Are Groot kind of moment at the end. But I shed a few tears, you know, with Peter and his mum when he was a child. You know, I just thought something about that worked, and kind of, you know, in contrast to what you said about this one, felt sort of natural and, you know, not too overworked. Whereas here it did feel like it was laid on very thick. And there were a couple of sort of tender moments that worked for me. And of course, like the baby Rocket is so cute, you know, it's hard not to feel it or something when you see his little eyes, you know, like sort of sniffing right around the camera. It's nice, his relationship with these other creatures that he's stuck with, you know, in these flashbacks. But I thought it was laid on too thick, a bit too traumatic, you know, given the nature of the rest of the film. It kind of piled on so much that I often have this problem with films, that when it's piled on too much, I just feel it less almost, because I don't know, just the sort of subtler, the better for me often with that kind of stuff, because I start to detach from it a bit. Like a film I always think of when it comes to this is, I feel it particularly with Paddy Considine's Tyrannosaur. That's an example I always come back to for when I want to explain this point. But when just so much negative bad stuff is just piled on and on, yeah. I just stop feeling it, really. It just doesn't continue to move me. It just feels like too much. And I felt that with Rocket's backstory. I felt like it was just laid on too thick. It was like trying too hard to get you to cry over it. So that felt a bit manipulative. So yeah, the emotional side of it didn't work as well for me as just the sort of enjoyable Guardians romp side of it. And as Jordan said earlier, it didn't feel as much like a final chapter as I was expecting. It didn't feel like it had that gravity you expect from a final chapter, a conclusion to a big story, because obviously they've had two of their own films and then they've appeared in several other MCU movies, including, you know, two of the biggest in Infinity War and Endgame. So it didn't really feel like it had that. It just felt like a fun, another adventure with, you know, you had this idea in the back of your mind that, like, as Matthew was saying, you wonder who's going to survive the end of it. What's the team's going to be left like by the end. But yes, I didn't, for me, the emotional side of things just didn't really land.
So let's talk about the sort of rompy side of things. One of the sort of comedy characters is, of course, Groot, who has had various mishaps during the saga. And Drax, who is sort of this, he's the comedy element. He's even spoken about in this film about, you know, you are the funny one. Is there enough funny in this? Is there enough romping? Because for me, it felt like that also was a little strained. And then totally don't know anything about this, but it felt a bit like James Gunn had been pulled a little bit thin, and this was James Gunn on draft one, and this was sufficient and it hadn't had the care that perhaps the first Guardians had. I mean, he's a very busy man now. He's got a lot of projects on. I mean, I'm not sure when James Gunn is sleeping. He's also cast his brother in this.
His wife pops up in it as well.
Yeah. So it's like, it's a whole shebang, but it felt a little bit like it had been dashed off. And that sort of fun factor for me wasn't there that was in the first film. Was it for you, Jordan? Is there enough fun?
Yeah, I would say like most of my favorite moments were where it captured that original Guardians, especially the caper side of things. We should point out this is a two and a half hour film, so yeah. Obviously there's a lot of time to fill, and not all of that is going to be, you know, wall-to-wall zingers and fun antics, but there are some really creative, really inventive set pieces here. Matt mentioned the one set on this kind of fleshy bioplanet. There's a really great sort of shootout action sequence in that, featuring Nathan Fillion, obviously an old James Gunn regular going back to the Slither days. And there's a superb sequence later in the film, which is set in this corridor where you get to see the Guardians like show off their skills, essentially taking out this army of animal monsters, and it's all done in a kind of fake wanna, and it's just so stylish and slick, and it's set to a Beastie Boys track, and that was the moment where I was like, all right, finally we're here, we've arrived at the moment where the promise of what these films could be has been achieved in terms of the action and the comedy and how that all comes together. But most of my favorite moments just involved usually Drax and Mantis just bickering and going off on one at each other. That was a really funny moment where they arrive on this counter-Earth planet. They go to this animal person's house, and Drax decides that he wants to like lie down on this couch, and everyone's saying, oh no, that's really impolite, don't lie down on the couch. And that was just cracking me up like majorly. I just find Drax a very funny presence, and I don't think that has waned throughout three films plus multiple other appearances. So I mean, ironically enough, because Dave Bautista is the one who seems to be the least interested in continuing playing Drax in the future, he's the one where I'd be interested to see more stories involving that character, just because I find him just relentlessly funny and entertaining to watch.
I agree. I thought him and Mantis were MVPs here, and they're the funniest moments. They also probably for me had the most touching moments as well in the film. Again, in a more low key way. But yeah, I just thought they had some very funny interactions, some nice moments. I enjoyed those two a lot.
And Nebula. Yeah, really. Yeah. I think she'd sort of blossomed into a really interesting character. She's so much a sort of product now of all of her experiences that she is funny. She's also harsh. She's also kick-ass. She's all the things that she's been in this series. And actually, I was like, Nebula is the one that I wish the same care had been taken with everyone else's characterization.
she's the one who feels like she's grown the most over the course of the series compared to, I mean, she was just really a sort of a henchwoman in the first movie. But over the course of this, yeah, she has kind of really come into her own and experienced a sort of broader spectrum of human emotion. So, yeah, I felt that was kind of one of the most satisfying arcs, really, in the whole series.
I really like Karen Gillan's performance and I like the character. But one problem I have, which is a problem I have with a lot of superhero films, is she's been given this new bionic arm from Rocket, we're told, but it can literally just do anything. It can become a massive blaster. It can hack into computers. It can kind of just do anything she wants it to. And again, I just disengage when it comes to things like that. I feel like there's got to be some kind of restrictions on the characters, some things they can't do or some things they have to sort of work around. But she's just got this arm that can just do anything, you know, in a way that just defies any physics or reason. So that annoyed me. It also tied into another thing that annoyed me in the film, true of most modern superhero films, is it was just really unclear what people's limits were in terms of their powers and what's going to kill them, if you know what I mean. Because a couple of characters take bad blasts or bad stabbings and just survive seemingly without any issues. That just makes me think, well, what are the stakes? Especially when, as we were saying earlier, part of this film is you wondering, because you know it's the final installment, who's gonna survive at the end, you know, what's at stake in that sense. But early on in the film, we get someone gets stabbed right through the chest.
Yeah.
Someone gets blasted in the chest. Both are just completely fine afterwards. And then the whole story, as mentioned, hinges on Rocket's illness. He's kind of laid up in a sort of hospital bed. And the story hinges on this idea that they have these sort of Medipack things. Mm. That can just heal any injury seemingly. And the problem is that it can't heal Rocket's for a thing connected to his past, which they then go off and investigate. But it's just like, well, if you've just got a big supply of those, how's anyone going to ever be in that much danger? They've got like whole drawers full of these Medipacks that they just sling on. And it, you know, it's like this, you know, magical doctor item that can just heal anything. Yeah, I don't know. I just find it really hard to get invested in a world when you've got items like that.
And those items aren't available to everyone. It doesn't feel like everyone in their little citadel is privy to that tech. And certainly when you go to other planets, like the human animal hybrid planet, they're sort of in a sort of 1950s sort of styly world where they're all got sort of nice little houses and they're all sitting there, and then the sofas of the aforementioned Drax sofa scenario, they just felt like fodder, the other people in it, didn't they?
If I was in this world, I'd be carrying around a Medipack at all times, you know?
Exactly.
Like a bag full of them,
because you never know what's coming to land in your neighborhood.
Seems so dangerous.
Exactly.
There's a lot of collateral damage in this film as well. Yeah, for a film that's kind of so sensitive about some animals, such as Rocket and his companions. I mean, as we're discussing this now, it's one of those strange films for me where I actually enjoyed it more than a lot of recent Marvel films during the watching of it. I was entertained, wasn't bored. You know, it's a long running time, but I felt like it went along at a decent clip. But then it was one of those films that perhaps more qualms accumulated in my mind afterwards, if you know what I mean. Like, I kind of enjoyed it, but then the more I thought about certain things, I was like, I wasn't sure about that bit, actually. And I'm like, that didn't quite work. It was that strange experience where in the moment I perhaps enjoyed it more than how I felt when I rationalised it all afterwards.
On that level, would we say that we are recommending that people spend their hard-earned cash to get their popcorn, get their drink and sit and watch this weekend? It's out now. You can go enjoy this for 2.5 hours. Is it worth the money?
Yeah, I think if you've invested in the other movies, if you care about these characters, I mean, I think as a part threes go, I think it is probably better than average, and it's certainly an improvement on the second Guardians. So I think if you have those kind of feelings towards the series, I think it's worth seeing.
It'll let you know if you'll like it as well. As Matthew said, if you're already invested in the characters, if you like the last one, if you've enjoyed them all so far, it does deliver a lot of what you're after. You get a lot of bang for your buck, you know, as a night out. There's a lot going on. There are a lot of enjoyable moments. Just the main thing for me, it just doesn't reach the highs of the first film or the very best Marvel films for me. But I found it an enjoyable experience.
And you're not going to get your Easter eggs, really, are you? You're not going to get an amazing sort of, oh my God, post-credit sting that is going to really further anything, because it's designed not to, really.
Yeah. They sort of made me say, oh my God, in a slightly negative way. Like, I can't believe we're doing this. It's definitely not like Guardians 2 either, where you had like, what was it, 5 or 6 post-credit scenes?
Exactly, yeah.
two very simple, very straightforward post-credit scenes, back to the old style. But obviously we're not going to spoil those.
No, but there are two. Don't leave before the credits are finished, because there are two.
I would say this is worth the cinema trip ultimately, even though I was slightly mixed on it, because there is that real question now where it's, do you actually pay your money to go to the cinema to watch this, or do you wait 2.5 months for it to pop up on Disney Plus? I would say this is one of those films where there is enough kind of visual invention on screen, which has actually been achieved fairly successfully, I'd say. You know, very recently we've had like Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, where that was a film with some very ropey visual effects, which really didn't hold up when you saw it in the cinema. But this was a film where I thought, actually, a lot of this has been achieved quite successfully and it's quite well rendered. So I would say if you're going to see it, then it's worth watching it at the cinema.
And to get that, you know, those needle drop soundtrack moments on a really good sound system, because there's some good absolutely. Music in this.
We shouldn't spoil it, but it opens with a very unexpected song and a very unexpected walk through a city, which I very much enjoyed.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so that is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, and it is out in cinemas now. There's not really much else to discuss. That's the biggie. That's, you know, the one to see this week. So a reminder that if you like this podcast, come back next week. We will be talking about more releases, but you can make your life easier by subscribing. We should also mention that, as Matt said, our current issue is out on sale right now. It's on shelf. It's Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. What did you learn in talking to Harrison Ford, Matt?
Lots. I learned a lot about myself speaking to Harrison Ford, but also lots about...
about yourself.
This turned into a therapy. What did you learn about yourself, Matt?
Well, just that I can handle very stressful situations. Yes, I learned a lot from Harrison Ford. He's definitively says this is his last Indiana Jones film. So this is it. Prepare for your last go as Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, you know. And as he said, like, this isn't your fifth James Bond. This is your original Indiana Jones. So come on, who can resist that?
Yeah. And where did you end up talking to Harrison Ford, Matt?
In a photo booth of a busy mainline train station in London, where I kind of... I've been waiting for the interview, but then, of course, it drops at the very last minute when I'm not expecting it and have to make a mad dash to a sort of vaguely quiet place and pray for no big announcements over the speaker system while I'm on the phone to him, and pray that nobody comes in needing a passport photo. And thankfully, I was okay on both counts, but it was a very hairy experience, and I was absolutely wild on adrenaline afterwards. I just was so kind of pumped. I just couldn't sleep for hours afterwards.
It's, you know, in the vein of Indiana Jones, you know, why do it in a normal fashion when you can do it on the fly? So yes, do pick up our latest issue. It is on sale now. Right, before we go, we have a reader's question. This is an interesting one. Are live action adaptations of animated films a good idea?
I mean, it's a really tricky one for me. Like, there's something, I feel this, and I felt this when I was younger, and I suppose it's similar to, you know, adapting anything like a book. There's always part of you that just wants to see what it would look like with real people, I suppose. There's always a kind of, there's always an intrigue there. It's like, what would this look like if it's actually real? But I mean, quite a lot of the time it can strip away the magic, I think. But there have been successful instances. And like I thought, like, as I said earlier today, actually, that Peter Pan and Wendy was like a classy version of that idea. But whether it was strictly necessary, I'm not entirely sure. You know, you need to approach it in a particular way, because animation can just get away with something that live action just can't. I'm vaguely nervous as to how the live action Moana that Dwayne Johnson announced will go.
Yeah.
Because I love Dwayne Johnson, obviously, but and I love him as Maui in the film. His sort of vocal performance and the design of the character and everything. But I feel like it will look a bit silly in live action. But I mean, I'm willing to be proven wrong. And I feel like The Little Mermaid will be an interesting test case, because also another feature I have in the current issue of Total Film, where I spoke to the team behind that. But that occupies and weird in between ground between something like Peter Pan and The Lion King, because it's sort of live action in the sense of having real actors, but obviously there's a significant visual effects component, and, you know, where they're obviously half fish, and there's obviously some CGI animals in there as well as supporting characters. And in things like The Lion King and Dumbo, it never entirely works for me, because something about having them rendered so realistically just draws attention to the fact that, like,
that they're not,
and that Dumbo could never fly, you know. And in The Lion King, you need the exaggerated, like, emotions that you get on the face when lions are going through this kind of Shakespearean tragedy or singing these big show tunes, which just feels a bit odd. It's like, it's kind of like The Lion King felt like an impressive experiment that just didn't quite work to me. And so I'm just intrigued to see where the Little Mermaid will sit on that scale. But what do others think? I've waffled on now.
Yeah, I mean, that. Thanks for coming to Matt's TED Talk. Jordan, is it a no or a yes for you?
Well, my hot take is that I don't think there's ever been a single worthwhile, specifically Disney, animated to live action adaptation. Like, they've all ultimately felt like exercises in fleecing people from their money, to be
just
honest.
Just repackaging content, like, so that you can sell it another way in a new fashion.
Yeah, I was looking through the list ahead of this podcast, and there just isn't one that I'd give more than 3 stars to, if I'm honest. Like, and that's just sort of the definition of middle of the road, kind of time-filling content for what has ultimately become their streaming service. Like, I don't think any of them really have much creative drive. Like, the closest one to being actually worthwhile is David Lowery's Peach Dragon, I would say. That's the one where it felt like you had a real filmmaker with a little bit of vision who did something very different to the original version. But when you've got things like The Lion King or Aladdin or Beauty and the Beast, where it's literally just the animated film filmed with real people,
They look exactly the same. Like,
I just don't see what
don't
the point
understand
is.
It. Yeah,
it just makes no sense to me at all. Often they don't have new songs. Often they're just reusing the same songs again. Like, the only reason that makes sense is that they're doing it to make money. Like, I really don't know why we're living through this era, to be honest, other than to keep these kind of brands and these names alive. But I personally don't think that it affects my enjoyment of the originals in any way. Like, I still love the original films, the original Beauty and the Beast, the original Dumbo. But yeah, I don't see a reason for them to exist beyond commercial prospects.
I've got a question for Jordan. How do you feel about the upcoming remake of How to Train Your Dragon?
I'm not looking forward to it, to be honest. I adore those films. It does have a few of the original creatives involved, which obviously makes me a bit more intrigued that they're going to treat it respectfully and do it right. But again, it's just like, I just can't imagine how that's going to look in live action, because, you know, Hiccup and Toothless, they're just very specific looking types that I just don't think you could render them exactly in live action and they would be anywhere near as charming. You know, you'd have to make Toothless a bit more realistic and a bit more kind of aggressive and scary. And that's just not Toothless.
You just want him to look exactly the same, don't you?
Exactly.
Did you ever see that promotional video where he was like messing around with Kit Harington? I can't remember if it was
Two
or three.
Yeah.
So you just want him like that, just exactly the same as he is in the anime.
That just can't be the case just because it's too cartoony for live action. So yeah, you just lose a lot of the charm as well in the translation to live action. I mean, with something like Beauty and the Beast, for example, I just thought the Beast looks so great in the animated version, and then in live action he just looks a bit like, I don't know, I wouldn't want to give him a hug, you know, like, he looks horrible.
Oh, anti-Beast sentiment. Matthew, you're being quiet. Do you have a thought about this?
I think it's kind of a shame that they're doing these remakes and it's kind of pushing away the originals, because they used to be re-released on quite a regular basis. Things like the older ones, like the Jungle Book and Snow White, they seem like they would come around every couple of years in cinemas, but they're not really doing that anymore. And I wonder if it is because of these remakes. So it's a shame not to be able to show, like, the next generation, show your own children these films on the big screen. And obviously they're readily available on Disney Plus, but it's not quite the same as taking the family to see something like the original Lion King on the big screen. So I feel like that's kind of been lost there, really. I mean, I think they all sort of hit a certain standard, all these remakes. And I enjoyed The Lion King the most just because of the effects. But I mean, if you revisit those probably in 10, 20 years, they're going to have started to wane. So it's kind of in the moment.
I don't mind like a Maleficent or a Cruella, where we've taken an aspect of the original and expanded it and it's in live action. So it has room to breathe. But yeah, that whole carbon copy facsimile situation doesn't really work for me. It feels as I'm with Jordan on this. It feels like a money grabbing exercise. And that, again, it's that whole Guardians thing. Is if you can see manipulation, you feel it happening to you, then it doesn't have the desired impact. But who knows? So for now, let's say goodbye. You can do it in your best Disney goodbye. Jordan.
Goodbye.
That was Stitch from Lilo and Stitch.
Very good. Matthew.
Goodbye.
Oh, very good. Oh my God, the pressure's on.
How can I follow these? I just try. Well, let me try doing Mickey Mouse. Bye. That's terrible.
That was Mickey Mouse. It sounded like he expired.
That was awesome.
We won't be here next week. We're taking a break, but we will be back the following week. So do join us then. We will see you in 2 weeks.